Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very excited for this one. I'm speaking with Clive Young about his book from Lewith Press, published in 2023, titled Unlocking Scots, The Secret Life of the Scots Language, which pretty much does what it says on the tin, looks to uncover the secret life of Scots, the language, both what's happened historically, the centuries of debate, the centuries of all sorts of things happening to the language, all the way really up to the present. So this book packs quite a lot in to the discussion of the Scots language. Clive, thank you so much for being with us to tell us all about it.
Oh, thanks very much for inviting me. That's a real treat. So Unlocking Scots, it came out this summer, I think it was June, and I was trying to capture the discussion, which has kind of spanned centuries, really, on the nature and history of the Scots language, its place in society, and really, towards the end of the book, a little bit about its future. You know, what can we do about it? So I suppose why do we write this book anyway? As you probably tell from my accent, I'm Scottish. I was born and educated in Scotland, and when I was young, when I was a child, I was a bairn in Scots. I learned Scots in east central Scotland, East Lothian, Fife, and Perthshire. If people know Scotland at all. I'm now retired, but I was a biologist by training. But I worked as an educational consultant, you know, in universities and on both sides of the border. I'm now living in London, but looking forward to going back to Scotland, in Glasgow next year. So I've had a long interest in languages, and particularly languages in society and how they work in society. And I think that was maybe partly due to that bilingual, being brought up bilingually between Scots and Scottish English. But also I had a kind of connection, a long connection with Catalonia and Spain, where the language questions were quite prominent. And I became kind of fascinated by the politics of language. And eventually went back to study a little bit more language in more depth, study English and so on. But the real reason why this book is was written, really, and it's good, I've been writing it about 10 years, really, was that the linguistic situation in Scotland is kind of complicated with Scots and quite controversial. Huh? So the book was a kind of attempt to capture this long debate and see what the various sides were, what the various arguments are. And as I say, at the end of the day, what should we do about it? Scots is a linguistic entity, a part of our culture. What should we do about it?
Thank you for taking us through that bit of background. I think that's helpful to know sort of how you came to the book before we sort of start talking about it in more detail. Is there anything before we kind of get into what's happened to Scots as a language? Do you want to tell us anything about the language itself?
I think Scots is quite unusual. Throughout the book, I call Scots a language, yeah, because that's essentially what it is. But there's a debate in Scotland about, is it a dialect, is it just bad English, and so on. And this is a debate that actually goes back centuries. So what I kind of call Scots is is almost a kind of literary language. So if you're in Scotland and you went back in time, in a time machine, about 100 years, you know, early part of the 20th century, you'd hear most people speaking Scots. So Scots would be a language which is very, very close to English, but noticeably different. A slightly different grammar, lots of different vocabulary, and so on and so on. And, at that time, the early 20th century, people were writing field studies of Scots and grammars. There was already dictionaries. And early part of the 20th century, there was a kind of like a sort of second renaissance of Scots as a language. Scots always had a kind of a literary history. Robert Burns and Henry Dunbar, and all these, there's a lot of kind of writers in there. And as I say, in the early 20th century, through Hugh McDermott and so on, there was another, what do you call Scots renaissance. So at that time, Scots was quite clear. But what's happened over the last century, really, is Scots hasn't really been supported. We'll come to that in a little bit more detail, I'm sure, but it's not really been supported in education or by the government or anything like that. And it's become much more, when it's spoken now, it's spoken in a mix with English, or really the Scottish form of English, which is Scottish English. So if you're in Scotland nowadays, you know, you go out to the streets in Scotland nowadays, you'll hear people speaking all sorts of kind of varieties of a mixture between Scots and Scottish English. And sometimes that's quite understandable. If it's a mixture is quite English-like, if it's quite Scots-like, it might be less understandable if you don't know the linguistic environment. And on top of that, there's also some dialectical differences as well. If you went up to like Aberdeen or Shetland, you know, the kind of north, northeast of Scotland, then you'd find people speaking another way again. It's still Scots, and they still use Scots English, but it's there's quite a strong dialectical part of that as well. So it's quite a complicated linguistic situation. And the way that people speak nowadays, I in the book I say it's a bit like if you've heard of Spanglish, you know, that kind of mixture between Spanish and English, which is spoken in the North America along the, you know, the Texas and Mexican border. And that's a language variety which is quite dynamic. It varies a lot up along that border. But it's neither English and it's not Spanish either. So I think what people, the vernacular Scots, is often that kind of mixture between them. It's really quite dynamic. And people sort of like mixed up in different ways. You know, if you're a kind of skilled Scots speaker, you can use a lot of Scots. If you're speaking in kind of formal environments, then you may use, in fact, most likely to use more English. If you're speaking with people you don't know, you'll use more English. If you're speaking about, I don't know, technical things or speaking in the university or whatever, you're going to use a lot more English. But in the kind of, so Scots is more familiar, in the kind of more familiar territory of the home, friends, down the pub, informal conversations, that sort of thing. So I think when you think about Scots, is on one side you've got this kind of literary heritage language, and then you've got the kind of modern implementation of that, the way that people speak it on an everyday basis, where you have this strange, not really strange, it's quite exciting, dynamic mixture between Scots and Scottish English. And of course, in Scotland, a lot of people will just speak English. There are a Scottish version of English as well. So that's what I mean by it's quite complicated. And really, why I was got around to writing the book was I couldn't make any sense of it myself. So I thought if I sit down and read everything that people have written about it, I'll make some kind of, I'll be able to map out really what the story of Scots is. And that might give us some pointers about how we can treat it slightly better, hopefully, in the future.
Well, let's do some mapping out of that now ourselves. Obviously, sort of a highlights to our level of the book, but, you know, let's start off. Obviously, as you hinted at in that answer, sort of one reason it's so dynamic now is because of how it's been treated in the past. Can you take us through, in the book, you outline five stages that have resulted in the repression of Scots?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think most writers, you know, point to the loss of political autonomy of Scotland at the very early part of the 18th century. That was 1707. There was a union of the Scottish and English parliaments. And although there's a lot of kind of Scottish cultural practices, if you like, which are enshrined in that union, including law and religion and education, language just wasn't one of them. And so Scotland had the kind of misfortune of joining England just at the time when the English language was beginning to develop itself, or trying to develop itself, as the global language it has become. Yeah. So this was like the early part of the 18th century, 1700s and so on. There was a lot of pressure in England to try to purify the English language, you know, they're trying to get rid of all sort of kind of nastiness out of it, make it sort of like a high-level language suitable for the, you know, for the empire and kings and all that sort of stuff. And of course, poor old Scots came into that, and it was immediately identified. Before the union, it had just been a normal language, if you like, used by government and so on. It was identified as this kind of substandard or defective tongue, which really people should not speak it. You know what I mean. So, and of course, when there's this kind of union with England and Scotland, it's sort of like the bourgeoisie and the people in power in Scotland, they tend to go into England a lot, and they were quite embarrassed about the way they spoke. Yeah, so they had this kind of like inferiority complex around the language. So during the so that was the kind of first thing, if you like. Then during the as 18th century progressed, the upper echelons of Scottish society became Anglicised. Now, it wasn't just by chance. They had, you know, people came up from England and in order to teach them how to speak English properly, you know. So by the end of the 18th century, the upper levels, sort of the upper middle class and the upper classes were pretty much English speakers. Whereas the people on the street, if you like, and the people out in the countryside, they were more likely to be Scottish speakers. So you've got the kind of what happened there is the Scots then became a class-based language. So it was kind of the working classes, rural classes spoke Scots or fairly pure Scots, and most of the middle classes started moving towards English. But then the problem for Scots then was that when you think about the end of the 18th century, the 19th century, the education system started to become more developed in Scotland, as in everywhere else. It was the Anglophones, it was the Anglophone middle classes who really led that. And they, part of their ethos was to get rid of Scots from the classroom. It wasn't easy. It took them about 100 years, but they eventually, you know, managed to do that. So really, Scots has been pretty much excluded from education, not completely, but pretty much excluded from education in Scotland until fairly recent times. And so there's a kind of an interesting, in the book, I make a kind of point here is that in the 19th century, right, remember Scotland had been being anglicised now for a century or so. There was a kind of what we call nationalist movements across Europe, you know, in the Balkans, Scandinavia, all sorts of places like that, where there were real resistance to the empire's and foreign rule of the day. Never really happened in Scotland, and it's been a mystery for historians. Why did that happen? There's economic reasons, but one of the reasons, cultural reasons, I say, is because what happened with these sort of nationalist movements is that the intellectuals then kind of found solidarity with the people of the country. You know, this sort of there's a turn to the kind of popular culture. But in Scotland, that was impossible because the intellectuals had already been anglicised. They were speaking a different language. So there's no way a popular national movement could ever arise in Scotland based on that language difference. So so Scotland kind of remained, if you like, from that really early union. It didn't really have that nationalist, or not in the kind of political form anyway, that nationalist politicisation of language. And then basically you've got in the 20th century, and this is a problem really with all minority languages, is you've got the kind of broadcast media, essentially, you know, starting with printing and then films and radio and TV and now social media. So you've got English as this incredibly powerful global language, which is always going to put pressure on Scots as well. So where other minority languages have tried to deal with that is they make sure that the language, the minority language, is taught in schools, you know, so people have that kind of basic knowledge and build up a kind of pride in the language. In Scotland, that's not happened, right, for a number of reasons we might talk about later. So you've always got this kind of pressure to, you know, move towards more English ways of speaking. And actually, the you know, on top of that, I promise you mentioned this as well, that the suppression of Scots in schools was quite brutal, actually. It didn't happen to me, but, I mean, almost anybody who you speak about Scots in education, they were beaten physically for speaking Scots. It's horrific. You know, it's a real shame in Scottish history, is that people got hit with belts and sticks and stuff like that, just for speaking Scots in the classroom. It's quite a brutal regime. And that's left a long shadow of kind of shame, which is really quite sad. And I think a lot of the, you know, when we talk about later about, you know, trying to revitalise Scots, trying to get over that shame is actually quite a hard one. And it goes back generations, you know.
No, very much. And I think I'm going to ask you a bit more about that as we go. But first, I sort of want to clarify something, because I think some listeners might be going, hang on, I wasn't maybe aware of Scots, perhaps, but Scotland does have another language, Gaelic or Gaelic, depending on where you're from. And of course, in the last decade or so, maybe two decades, there has been sort of more prominence around Gaelic on road signs and schools, things like that. Before we go farther into Scots, can you help us understand why there's been less protection and activism around Scots, given that there is sort of almost the example to follow or a parallel issue with Gaelic?
Yeah, it's interesting because we have this, and this is really, again, another unusual aspect of Scottish linguistic culture, is we have these two minority languages. I would be wrong to say they're competing, but probably to some extent they do. I mean, you're absolutely right. In Scotland, there's a kind of broad consensus among politicians and most of the public that Gaelic should be protected as a national language. I mean, that's quite... I think it's quite a generosity of spirit there, but it's not often extended to Scots. And it's not because people don't want that to happen. There's been lots of attitude studies over the last 20 or 30 years, including one just last year, and showing that people are actually quite, Scottish people are quite in favour of building up the status of Scots, revitalising it, if you like, and getting it used more normally in Scottish public and cultural life, but the bulk of the funding, and it is the vast bulk of the funding, goes to Gaelic. I mean, the differences are quite... I'll not even mention them; they're so embarrassingly different, really. There's about 60,000 to 70,000 Gaelic speakers. Okay, now Gaelic is a language, a Celtic language, which is very, very similar to Irish. And less similar to Welsh and so on, but it's fairly small number of speakers. And nowadays they are mostly in the Western Isles. That's Lewis and Harrison, those little islands really off the west coast of Scotland. There's still some people in Skye, another island, but a bit closer to mainland Scotland. I mean, poor Gaelic has suffered terrible, terrible repression over the years as well, and much the same way as Scots was, and for much of the same reasons. And I think that's why it has kind of retreated. At one time, it's spoken over quite a lot of parts of Scotland, but over the years, it's been retreated or pushed, if you like, over to the top, you know, the top northwest corner of Scotland. So it's really on the back foot. Why is it got more support? Well, I think there's a number of reasons. There was never any question that Gaelic was a language, although I say it's very close to Irish. It's always been recognised as a distinct language. And I think there's been a long history of Gaelic of organisation around the language, you know, from the 19th century onwards. You know, there's sort of like around the Maud, which is a musical festival, a very big festival, mostly around romantic or cultural activities. The Gaelic speakers have been quite well organised. It's been quite a middle-class group who've done that. So when there's an upsurge of political interest started around about the 1950s or 1960s, particularly with Welsh, Gaelic community were well able, if you like, to, you know, exploit that, if you like. So the campaigns for Welsh in the 1960s, maybe into the 1970s, were quite aggressive, and the government really had to respond. And of course, if you respond to one Celtic language, you kind of really have to respond to the other one. The situation in Ireland and Irish is a little bit different. Probably don't have time to go into today, but basically, it was it was almost like they had to do it. You know, if you're going to support Welsh, then you have to support Gaelic. And there's not really much political cost in supporting Gaelic because, as I say, it's a small, fairly isolated community. You know, there's not going to be upsurge of nationalism caused by Gaelic. You know, there's no political threat. So it's quite, you know, it's a kind of a fairly easy win, really, for politicians to support Gaelic. But that's only part of it. And I think I'm hopefully not being unfair with that analysis. But I think also there is a kind of template for Gaelic. So if you take what's happened in Scotland with Gaelic and what's happened in Wales, and I think maybe even before that, people say that that was copied from French in Quebec. There's this kind of standard template you do for language revitalization. You know, so you start with you get a board, you get standardization, you get policies. You increase the presence of the language in broadcasting and education and so on and so on. So it was quite easy for politicians to do stuff with Gaelic, basically. When in Scots, for the reason I've just mentioned, there's not really kind of an off-the-peg formula. It's something that we have as Scottish people to kind of develop ourselves. And there's really not many places we can look at for a model. And I think we've kind of, because it's complicated, I think we've kind of lost an opportunity since devolution was the establishment of the Scottish Parliament around about a little over 20 years ago. And I think we've kind of lost that opportunity to really think about Scots and say, well, why is there this disparity between Gaelic and Scots? You know, why is one treated with much more respect and funding and so on than the other? You know, there's Gaelic TV channels, there's no Scots TV channels, and so on. So I think we kind of lost the opportunity to have that debate. I mean, all credit to our Gaelic colleagues, though. I mean, I think they, as you quite rightly say, they have kind of forged their way forward, and a lot of the issues that they're faced with actually are not that different from Scots. But they're far further down the path than Scots is in terms of political organisation, and they have the funding. And it's a kind of it's a virtuous circle. Once you have the funding, then you can organise better. Scots is still in the kind of vicious circle kind of thing. No funding, poorer community organisation and so on.
Well, and also one of the things you talk about in the book is that if someone used Gaelic on, for example, Twitter or some other sort of social media, there might be people going kind of, oh, I don't understand that, or wait, why are you making this complicated? But that would probably be the extent to which there'd be some pushback. Whereas you document with when people use Scots in the media or social media, there's a much stronger negative reaction. Why?
Yeah, it's quite bizarre, isn't it? I think there's a number of things going on. Kind of like social media, like Twitter or whatever it's called now, there's a little bit more tolerance there, but you're quite right. People kind of pick on Scots in a way they don't pick on Gaelic. Gaelic, by the way, there are people quite strongly against Gaelic, by the way. There is some commonality there between the two languages, but certainly they come in quite heavily on Scots. And I think there's a number of things, I think. One is there's a kind of class bias, you know, that, you know, what I talked about in the history of Scots and about the anglicisation of the upper classes, middle classes. I think Scots is still seen as this dreadful, common, low-class, bad language, you know. And that sometimes comes through kind of families or whatever, but also from school. And so it's an easy target, if you like. And it's often mixed up with kind of the other big political divide in Scotland is between Scottish and British nationalism, where Scottish nationalists tend to be more supportive of the language, let's say, and British nationalists, which would be like the major England-based parties, they are pretty ambivalent, at least, about any expression of Scottish culture. So when you've got that kind of heady mix of, well, we look down on this language and it's representative Scottish and, you know, independent culture, well, I can mock that as much as I want, sort of thing. And actually, there's a kind of even worse, I think. So there's kind of tradition in Scots, but Scots is often used for humour. It's often used in, humorous song and sketches on the TV and the stage. And we think of people like Billy Connolly and, you know, people like that. And that's a great asset of Scots. It's a very good vehicle for humour. It's a very, you know, it's an informal language. It's a very familiar language. People feel a lot of recognition with it. So it's a great vehicle for humour. But there's also this tradition in kind of British culture, maybe in all cultures, I suppose, is that ridiculing working class and rural people, you know, and their culture and the way they speak. So there's a kind of, this all kind of mixes up in a quite a heady, a really unfortunate mix of it's obviously kind of quite disdain, sometimes hate. It's quite horrible, actually. And that's the worst thing. But I think there's also more generally, it's a kind of unfamiliarity. I mean, if you've only been exposed to like odd bits of Scots and comedy stuff on the television, when people start talking about Scots in a kind of more serious way, people are just not familiar with it. They say, what's this all about, you know? And certainly seeing written Scots, I don't know if I'll have time to look at later, there's been a great loss over the last 30 years of literacy in Scots language. So people are not familiar to seeing normal Scots written down online or in books or anything like that. So all this thing kind of mixed together and they become a quite heady brew. It's quite, when people are sort of like, unfortunately, it's often women, by the way, it's often young women who when they speak Scots or they sing in Scots or they, you know, do poems in Scots, they often get quite targeted by it. I think there's something kind of weird going on about that. So it's a mixture of all these things. But you're quite right. It's like almost like a revulsion. It's really weird, to be honest. And I feel as a society, I feel quite ashamed for it. I think as a society, we should have moved on from that. I think the idea of sort of casual discrimination and, we should be moved on from that, really. But we haven't. Not quite yet.
In addition to those divides that you've just sort of sketched for us, you also document in the book that there's very much a divide between sort of normal everyday people and politicians when it comes to sort of how prevalent the Scots language is today, what people want to see with it going forward. Can you sort of take us through what this divide looks like?
Yeah, so there's not a lot of, let's say, research in the way that people use Scots. I mean, a lot of it's based on, you know, just what you hear in the streets. The closest we got to was in 2011. There was a census. We do a census in the UK every 10 years and ask lots of questions to do with society. And one was, what languages do you speak? And there was a really big surprise that the results of that came out in 2013. And there's a population of Scotland is a little over 5 million. And about 1.5 million, that's a lot of people, said they spoke Scots. You know, it was quite astonishing. It was like a kind of like this expression of Scottish cultural autonomy, and nobody ever seen this before. And I have to say, I think the authorities and the academics didn't really know how to respond to it, really. So there's a lot of Scots there in Scottish vernacular culture. You know, what that actually means, and if I said I spoke Scots, what does it actually mean? Well, there's a few questions around that, but all the kind of census questions are always self-declaration. So if I said I spoke Welsh, nobody's going to say to what level or anything like that. So there's a lot of Scottish culture out there. And when the public, I think I mentioned earlier, when the public are ever asked, they're not asked very often, what do you think you should do with Scots? And nearly always the majority answer is, we should develop it more, it should be more prominent in education, more prominent in broadcasting, and so on. And this has been true for a long time. But politicians have not really picked up on that. And there's a number of reasons for that. If you listen to the debates in the Scottish Parliament, if you you probably don't want to, but if you did, it's nearly all in English. It's mostly in English. So it's a very anglicised environment, and you've got then the kind of political divide between Scottish nationalists who currently run the parliament and what sometimes called unionists, which are the, you know, the more British nationalists. So if you're in the Labour Party or the Conservative Party, the Liberal Democrats, or, you know, one of these unionist parties, they are going to be not going to be supportive of Scots positive policies, because language is quite an important indicator of national identity everywhere. So they see it as a bit of a threat, so they tend not to support it. What's really more interesting is the Scottish National Party, the SNP, who, as I say, currently run the Scottish government. They were quite enthusiastic in the past, but I think when the census results came out, 2013, they suddenly kind of cooled, I think, their support for Scots, because that's a lot of people. And if you're going to sort of like support a language for so many people, it costs money, you know. And if you've the only model you've got is the one for a Gaelic, I mean, Gaelic speakers get like this equivalent of something like, I'm sure I read it somewhere, about £750 per person support, you know, include all the kind of television channels and all that sort of stuff. And the equivalent figure for Scots is currently is 17 pence. Less than 20 pence a person. That's how much Scots get supported. There's a little bit of support for Scots, but it's fairly trivial. So I think there's a sudden panic, you know, and they say, well, oh my goodness, we can't really push Scots because that's going to be a lot of money, or it could be a lot of money, and that gives ammunition for our opponents, yeah? And there's a couple of other things as well. The Scottish National Party, despite its name, it's not really very strong on cultural issues. It tends to steer away from anything that might be accused of being like ethnic nationalism, you know. So, and in a sense, quite rightly so. But you know, language is that has that kind of connotation to it. So they tend not to. They tend to be very low key on that sort of stuff. And there's also the potential of Scots, promotion of Scots being a bit divisive for all the reasons I've mentioned earlier. You know, there's not a huge consensus on it, though people want to support it. When it actually comes down to nitty-gritty spending it, using it in education, they are fearful of a bit of a backlash. The Scottish media is very ambivalent towards Scots as well. We've got a number of newspapers, we've got a branch of the BBC and ITV, independent television. And they're all very ambivalent and sometimes quite negative about Scots. So I think if you're a political party, there is a kind of reasons why you wouldn't support it, to be honest. there's other things as well, but that's the reason. So politicians, is big. I think there's a big disjunct, if you like, between what the politicians think and what the public think.
So could you do a bit more of that comparison that you did just a little bit there in terms of monetary support? If we think about Scots as a minority language, we can compare it not just to Gaelic or French in Quebec, but also to minority languages within the EU. How does Scots stack up in that comparison?
Oh, my goodness. So so we've got the EU has been very positive about language diversity and support for minority languages for quite a long time, actually. And I think that that stemmed out post-war, you know, human rights ideology, you know, the dreadful things that happened in the Second World War. I think there was a much more focus on people's rights, you know, and again, rightly so, including language. And over 20 years ago, the UK government signed into an agreement called the European Charter for Regional and Minority Languages. It's a bit of a long title. But that kind of represents the kind of European ideology, isn't quite the right word, but we'll call it ideology on supporting minority languages. Yeah, so the UK signed up for that, and many countries have signed up for that as well. And basically, what that said, there should be a right to use a minority language in public and private life. Okay, an inalienable right. Yeah, it's a great word, inalienable right for that, you know. And also there was need for resolute action to, you know, safeguard these threatened tongues. So back then, 20 years ago, there's quite so that included sort of Gaelic and Irish and Welsh, two varieties of Scots, Scots in Scotland and Ulster Scots in Ireland. And also, I think I added in Cornish, Manx, and was another one. I think, was it Channel Islands? I don't know. There's actually a number of languages there. But really, that was the sort of UK's response to it. But that represented really something that happened right across Europe. And most of my experience has been with in Catalonia and Spain. I've got kind of, you know, personal connections in. I've been going backwards and forwards for nigh on 30 years. I was there last weekend, actually. And so I've kind of watched over those times how Catalan, which is another minority language, certainly post-Franco, which is that from the 70s onwards, late 70s onwards, has raised in status from, you know, very much a repressed language to something which is fairly much, fairly, you know, accepted now as part of Catalan culture, in a process that they call normalization. And that kind of means that the language just has a kind of parity, if you like, with Castilian Spanish. So if you look at that kind of, you know, so if you think about Scots, the way I look at it is like Scots is like one end of the spectrum of really 17 pence a head, and you've got Catalan the other one, which is really a mainstream part of the you know, political, social, cultural environment. They're two very, very different ends of the spectrum. And other languages in Spain are somewhere in between there. I mean, sort of like, I talk in the book about Basque and how they had to create a standard Basque in order to get the various dialects speaking to each other. And I don't think I mentioned the book, but Galician is another one I'm interested in, where it's a very low status language that's, but even that, and really under a lot of threat, but even that gets loads more support than Scots does. I remember speaking to a Galician language activist some years ago, and she was saying that, or I gathered from her, that the support they got in their town in Galicia was more than the whole of Scotland got in terms of money, you know, and people working on the language. quite remarkable. And actually, I wonder, actually, is, I mean, I haven't done this work yet, but I will do, I think, is look at, you know, the way that dialects and languages are treated, not in Spain. Spain's a kind of a particular case study, but maybe places like, you know, Italy or Germany, where, you know, how these languages are supported and dialects are supported. I suspect Scots is pretty much at the bottom of the pile, pretty much. We are really very, very bad at this. Very bad at this.
So given that deficit then, what, I mean, obviously saying that like the goal is 3 years from now to be like Catalan, right? That's obviously not the goal. What would sort of normal look like for Scots today or in the near future?
Yeah, I think even in Catalan, I think, even in Catalonia, the normalization they regard as a process. It's never an end point. It's always an aspiration. You know, you're always trying to get there. And as I said earlier about these sort of like pressure from these big global languages, and you know, in Scotland it's obviously English, and Catalonia it's Spanish, and the it's almost impossible to completely balance that. You know, so the idea is that you have the first thing really is to stop you know, discrimination against speakers. That's really right across Europe. That would be the kind of like the common denominator, really. People should not be discriminated against because of the language or the variety of language or dialect or whatever they speak. Beyond that, it's the kind of normal and official use of the language, Scots in this case, and promote the use of Scots really at all levels of you know, public and cultural life on a basis of equality. So, you know, like, it's not like English is the top one, and if you press a button at the bottom, you'll get to Scots or, you know, Catalan, whatever it is. That is the kind of aim. So you've got this kind of it's like a respect agenda. You say, well, it's going to be, you know, roughly the same. And I think in Catalonia, that's pretty much achieved. It's not completely there, but it's pretty much achieved. And then the other thing about there is the need to enhance people's kind of literacy, if you like. I remember when it first, this was like 30 years ago, when it started going to Catalonia, you used to get kind of supplements in newspapers saying, this is how you speak Catalan, right? That was where it was 30 years ago. And I think we almost need that sort of thing there for the, you know, for everyday people saying, this is what Scots is, you know? This is how you can improve your skills in Scots. We're way, way off that. But I do think we need that sort of engagement and increase in people's literacy around the language. And I think part of that would be, you know, you see more regular use in, obviously in education, that's very important, but everyone should have the right to, you know, access Scots through that. But you know, regular use in public spaces, you know, signage and, you know, official transactions, government transactions and so on, you know, plenty of exposure and broadcasts and print, and not just simply the kind of comic stuff, you know, proper exploration of Scots. And probably better, my particular peeve is that we don't support Scots particularly well in the in universities either. We don't have much research going on in there as well. But and more support for Scots based arts and so, that sort of thing. So that's where we're heading for. So not normalization. So none of those are really saying like people will just speak Scots and nothing else. That's not really kind of aim. I just to kind of have this kind of you know, equality of respect, if you like. And I think that's what we're aiming for. Really, at this stage anyway.
To achieve a number of those goals, especially in education and any sort of kind of written down form, it would help, and as often as you talk about in the book, kind of a key step towards this normalization is standardizing, for example, how things are written down in Scots, which is not nearly as simple to say that as to do in practice. Why is the question of sort of creating a standard Scots so tricky?
It's kind of a weird one, actually. I think the, in a sense, because when we talk about Scots in its kind of slightly more purer form, less mixed up with English, a lot of that derives, or is very closely linked to the literary standard from maybe the late 19th, early 20th century. And certainly there was sort of grammars and so on that were produced based on that and field studies and so on. So, and you know, there's dictionaries and that. So in a sort of a sense, there was a kind of a literary standard. There is actually kind of a, if you look through the kind of mainstream dictionaries, and there's popular dictionaries and essential dictionaries and stuff like that, online dictionaries, they kind of represent that kind of form of written Scots, yeah? And I think partly people are just simply not aware of it. I was going to be able to say, I didn't know there's a written form of Scots, you know? And I spend a lot, probably too much time, on social media sort of trawling through kind of Scots-related stuff. And people don't even know that there is actually ever was, they don't even know there's actually dictionaries of Scots. It's quite, it just goes to show how the education system has really let down this linguistic community. Because if you don't even know there's dictionaries in your own language, you're in a bad state, you know, and so that's really a one problem. I think there's a couple other ones. One is the imposition of English in schools, as I said, was quite brutal, and I think people fear a kind of prescriptivism, you know, a sort of like harsh prescriptivism. So if I suddenly became the Scots language commissar, I'm not really looking for that job, I would then be beating up people if they didn't speak Scots properly. And honestly, and it sounds ridiculous, but honestly, that's what people fear. They think that Scots would be imposed in the same way that English was on them. And that's quite a hard thing to, that's quite a hard thing to battle against, really. There's also the issue I mentioned earlier about dialects. There's quite a lot of different Scots. Well, not a lot of them, but there's four or five different Scots dialects. They all have different varieties of Scots, and I think people who are very into their own dialects tend to feel that a standard Scots might be an imposition. You know, a kind of odd thing about Scots as well. And as I said earlier, because Scots has been such an informal spoken language, essentially, it has this kind of rebellious tinge. And if you read stuff across social media or poetry or anything like that, and modern novels, things like Trainspotting and that type of book, it often uses Scots or Scots linguistic themes as a kind of rebellious mode. You know, it's a way of demonstrating your rejection of mainstream society, right? And that's really kind of it's an artistic trope, really, rather than a popular one. But I think then artists often feel that, who have quite a lot of status in Scots, by the way, in the Scots language community, they feel, again, that would be stifling their creativity if you had a standard Scots. So my kind of response to that is that really we're only talking about a kind of formal Scots, written Scots. You know, nobody's asking, saying to anyone, you cannot speak your Scots-English mix in this way or your dialect mix. This is something you would use primarily for education, maybe a little bit for broadcasting, but really for kind of signage and official use, that type of stuff. So it's really a written, it's almost like a written, can you imagine, what we mean, a written dialect sort of thing of the language. And I don't know whether that kind of calms people down, but people feel very strongly about it, and it's you know, and I think if people feel, well, you're going to interfere the way I speak every day, aren't you a monster? You know, we always have to, in language revitalization, you have to start where people are. I think there's a lot of work needs to be done to kind of calm those kind of fears. I think there's also, there's one other thing about standardization is once you raise, if you standardize, you raise the status of Scots, it becomes an equivalent to English. Because it has a standard, you know, and currently it hasn't got a real standard. It's got a partial literary standard, but it hasn't got a real standard. And that opens up the opportunity for asking for rights. And I think there's a real kind of fear amongst some politicians that if you have a status for Scots, it means we have to do something about it in the same way as we had to do something about Gaelic in the 80s, 90s, and you know, 2000s. It becomes a much more... a much more kind of solid language we have to then act with. And as I say, they may fear that we may go down the same path, quite expensive path, that the support for Gaelic has had. So, it's quite a lot of issues there.
No, very much so. Given that we sort of discussed quite a number of things that politicians could do, whether or not they will, but could do for this, what sorts of things do you think communities or individuals could do to take part in a revitalisation of Scots?
Yeah. So I mentioned earlier, I think, or maybe I didn't, was that one of the reasons that politicians tend to have kind of ignored the kind of popular interest in Scots is there's not been a lot of kind of public demand, you know. So I mean, our Gaelic colleagues are quite good at lobbying for Gaelic in Parliament and amongst the public. But Scots has not really had that kind of mechanism for that. So there's not really been that kind of organised demand. I think I mentioned earlier there was it's a bit of a kind of a vicious circle, because if politicians don't provide money for communities to organise, then they can't find a voice. And if they can't find a voice, they can't get any money. You know, that's the way we are really with Scots. And I think you've also got to bear in mind the demographic of Scots speakers. As I mentioned, and this has been true really of the last 100 years, really increasingly so, most of the speakers are of working class or rural class, you know. So they kind of lack what, I always think it's a bit patronising term, but the cultural capital to organise around their language. Either they still feel that stigma of shame around the language, it's still, you know, still not gone away, or they don't have, you know, the time and the skills and so on to organise themselves. And a kind of interesting example of that, or a counter example of that, is in northeast Scotland, in around the Aberdeen area, where there's a dialect of Scots called Doric, the Doric, which is, it's a lovely dialect of Scots. And it's in that area, there's still quite a lot of Doric speakers. It's not a majority, but quite a lot of Doric speakers. But what's really interesting in that area is that there's a small group of middle-class Doric speakers, and they've been very effective at organising themselves around the support of Doric, often really much better than the mainstream Scottish community. So there's a kind of, we've got kind of a, what's the word? It's like a chicken and egg, really. The communities are not very well organised. So in the book, what we're saying is really, in the and this is a difficult call, actually, in the absence of, you know, much political support, communities really have to get together, and we have to become, we have to kind of curate our own language. It's a kind of a personal responsibility. We have to kind of resist the kind of discrimination and cultivate what I call linguistic loyalty, find fellow enthusiasts, find out as much as you can about Scots, look at literary Scots and see what you can learn from that. Of course, you know, develop your own dialects and so on alongside it. But mainly what we can do really as individuals, just use Scots a lot, you know, as much as we can. I mean, as I said earlier, then the vernacular in Scotland is this mixture between Scots and English. And if we can actually push that a little bit more down the Scots end of the spectrum. People really have to use it and really get away from this idea it's shameful to speak Scots. Use the language a lot more, you know, increase the number of Scots words and phrases you use, but then you've got to learn a little bit about it. And actually, the learning materials and so on in Scots is not great, to be honest. I'll maybe come back to that at the very end. So there's quite a lot there. I think there's a kind of a political thing that we need to do to get, you know, sort of find the kind of seed funding for that sort of thing. But ultimately, it's down to the communities. And if the communities don't engage and they don't want to do it, you know, this language will disappear, and that's really pretty much it. I mean, Scots, if you know about minority languages, the key element is what's called intergenerational transmission. And what that means is if parents don't teach the language, whatever language it is, to their children, that language will die out, right? And there's a great fear in the Scots community that is what's happening now, you know. So we don't have a lot of time really to organise ourselves. So it's really kind of build up your own, you know, confidence and be more active. Be more active in that.
And obviously books like this are a contribution to that. You've already mentioned little hints throughout, I think, of kind of, this is obviously, this book is not the end of your engagement with this. So before I let you go, could you tell us a bit about what you are working on now that this book is out?
So Unlocking Scots, I mean, it took a while to put together. It was about 10 years, actually, at the end of the day. But it was really desk research, because as I mentioned at the very beginning, I'm sort of based down in London just now, so I didn't really have access to apart from online access, I didn't really have access to interview people as I really wanted to do initially. So it's based on published material. So starting this winter, I'm going to try and reach out more to Scots speakers, activists, teachers, researchers, and so on, and try and get an idea of what people think now. And really, you know, how can we find a way forward? That was interesting. If you go back 2009, one of the early Scottish National Party SNP government activities was to have an audit of Scots language provision, and that was actually quite remarkable. Over 14 years ago now, it just showed how much Scots was out there. You know, I think I mentioned that before. There's a lot of Scots out there, but we're not very good at kind of identifying it. So I'd like to do a little bit about that, kind of revisit that type of thing and see how people are using Scots and so on, get an idea of, you know, different attitudes. And I think part of the thing I'd like to do, maybe I won't be able to do that, is to see if there's a kind of consensus around Scots, because the Scots language community, if that's a such a thing, of activists is often portrayed as quite fractious. You know, there's been attempts, for example, in the late 1990s to develop a Scots standard, you know, out of the the literary standard I mentioned earlier, to kind of modernise and update it. And I thought it was very excellent, but everyone fell out. And that never happened. And that is actually fairly typical, by the way, of minority language communities, that people tend to take things very, very seriously. And but I'm kind of wondering whether maybe we can move on from that as well, and we can find some kind of consensus, and that might help us kind of develop and move forward. I also mentioned I'm an educator, so I'm kind of interested in learning materials. I've done a grammar of Scots and lists of Scots phrases and words, and so over the next year or so, I'm going to redevelop and republish that. But also think really how we can use kind of more modern methods, not just like grammar book, but, you know, sort of social media, you know, video, maybe even AI, who knows, to try to build this kind of learning community. Maybe if we don't have funding, maybe it's online is maybe the way we should go. So there's a huge kind of project somewhere in there. So, you know, trying to get kind of an up-to-date view of what, you know, speakers and teachers and so on think about Scots, how we can build up the kind of materials around that, how we can engage with people. And also, I also mentioned just a little bit what we can learn from other language revitalization. As I said, my experience has mostly been with, Catalan, which is kind of like Rolls Royce, if you like, of language revitalization. We've got a Scots bicycle. We're just trying to pedal down the road. But there's a lot of other places where there's somewhere in between there. You know, as I mentioned, things about, you know, supporting for like German dialects and Italian dialects and smaller languages in Italy and so on. So, and I'm sure there's a lot we can learn from those as well. You know, it's not, what I'm saying is we don't need to replicate what's happened with Gaelic or Welsh or Irish. We need to find our own path forward. And I think if we can find a consensus of the of a route map and a map for us to take us to the next steps, I think that will be helpful for helpful for all of us, I think.
Very much so. Lots of exciting things coming up. Thank you for sort of briefly outlining them for us. At the end of the conversation, taking us through your book, titled again, Unlocking Scots, The Secret Life of the Scots Language, published by Lewith, as you said, in the summer of 2023. Clive, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Oh, it's been a tremendous pleasure speaking with you, and thanks very much for inviting me, and hopefully get a chance to read the book. It's a lot of really interesting backstory there.